Chapter 70, The Prosperous Reign of David. This chapter is based on 2 Samuel 5, verse 6 to 25, 6, 7, 9, 10. 20 miles from Hebron, a place was selected as the future metropolis of the kingdom. It had been called Salem. 800 years before, it had been the home of Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God. It held a central position in the country and was protected by hills. On the border between Benjamin and Judah, it was close to Ephraim and easy of access to the other tribes. To secure this location, the Hebrews must dispossess a remnant of the Canaanites, who held a fortified position on the mountains of Zion and Moriah. This stronghold was called Jebus, and its inhabitants, Jebusites. For centuries, Jebus had been looked upon as impregnable, but it was besieged and taken under the command of Joab, who, as reward, was made commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel. Jebus became the national capital, and its heathen name was changed to Jerusalem. Hiram, king of Tyre, now lent his aid to David in erecting a palace at Jerusalem. Ambassadors were sent from Tyre, accompanied by architects and workmen and costly material. The increasing strength of Israel in its union under David excited the hostility of the Philistines, and they again invaded the country, taking up their position but a short distance from Jerusalem. David, with his men of war, retired to the stronghold of Zion. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into mine hand?" And the Lord said unto David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into thine hand." David advanced at once, defeated them, and took from them the gods which they had brought to ensure victory. Exasperated by their defeat, the Philistines gathered a larger force and returned to the conflict. Again, David sought the Lord, and the great I Am took the direction of the armies of Israel. God instructed David, "Thou shalt not go up, but come upon them over against the mulberry trees. And when thou hearest the sound of a going in the tops of the mulberry trees, then thou shalt bestir thyself, for then shalt the Lord go out before thee, to smite the host of the Philistines." If David, like Saul, had chosen his own way, success would not have attended him. But he did as the Lord commanded, and he smote the host of the Philistines from Gibeon even to Gezer. And the fame of David went out into all lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all nations. 1 Chronicles 14, verse 16, 17. Ark returned to Jerusalem. Now that David was established on the throne, he turned to accomplish a cherished purpose, to bring up the Ark of God to Jerusalem. It was fitting that the capital of the nation should be honored with the token of the divine presence. David's purpose was to make the occasion a scene of great rejoicing and imposing display. The people responded gladly. The high priest and the princes and leading men of the tribes assembled at Kirjath-Jearim. David was aglow with holy zeal. The ark was brought out from the house of Abinadab and placed upon a new cart drawn by oxen, while two of the sons of Abinadab attended it. The men of Israel followed with shouts and songs of rejoicing, a multitude of voices joining in melody with the sound of musical instruments. David and the house of Israel played before the Lord, on harps, and on psalteries, and on timbrels, and on cornets, and on cymbals. With solemn gladness, the vast procession wound its way along the hills and valleys toward the holy city. But when they came to Nachan's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God, and took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his rashness. And there he died by the ark of God. Terror fell on the rejoicing throng. David was greatly alarmed, and in his heart questioned the justice of God. Why had that fearful judgment been sent to turn gladness into grief and mourning? Feeling that it would be unsafe to have the ark near him, David determined to let it remain where it was. A place was found for it nearby, at the house of Obed-Edom. God requires precise obedience. The fate of Uzzah was a divine judgment upon the violation of a most explicit command. None but the priests, the descendants of Aaron, were to touch the ark, or even look upon it uncovered. The divine direction was, "The sons of Kohath shall come to bear it, but they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die." Numbers 4, verse 15. The priests were to cover the ark, and then the Kohathites must lift it by the staves, which were placed in rings on each side of the ark. They should bear the ark upon their shoulders. Numbers 7, verse 9. There had been an inexcusable disregard of the Lord's directions. David and his people had engaged in a sacred work with glad and willing hearts, but it was not performed in accordance with the Lord's directions. The Philistines, who had no knowledge of God's law, had placed the ark upon a cart when they returned it to Israel. But the Israelites had a plain statement of the will of God in these matters, and their neglect of these instructions was dishonoring to God. Transgression of God's law had lessened Uzzah's sense of its sacredness. With unconfessed sins upon him, in face of the divine prohibition, he had presumed to touch the symbol of God's presence. God can accept no partial obedience, no lax way of treating his commandments. The death of one man, by leading the people to repentance, might prevent judgments upon thousands. The ark brings blessings to those who love the Lord. Feeling that his own heart was not wholly right with God, David feared the ark, lest some sin bring judgments upon him. But Obed-Edom welcomed the sacred symbol as the pledge of God's favor to the obedient. All Israel watched to see how it would fare with his household. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. David was led to realize, as never before, the sacredness of the law of God and the necessity of strict obedience. At the end of 3 months, he resolved to make another attempt to move the ark, and he now gave earnest heed to carry out the directions of the Lord. Again, a vast assemblage gathered about the dwelling place of Obed-Edom. With reverent care, the ark was placed upon the shoulders of men of divine appointment, and with trembling hearts, the vast procession set forth. By David's direction, sacrifices were offered. Rejoicing now took the place of trembling and terror. The king had laid aside his royal robes and attired himself in a plain linen ephod, as worn by the priests. The ephod was sometimes worn by others besides the priests. In this holy service, he would take his place before God on an equality with his subjects. Jehovah was to be the sole object of reverence. Again, the music of harp and cornet, trumpet and cymbal, floated heavenward, with the melody of many voices. And David danced before the Lord, keeping time to the measure of the song. David's dancing in reverent joy before God has been cited in justification of the modern dance. But in our day, dancing is associated with folly and reveling. Morals are sacrificed to pleasure. God is not an object of thought. Prayer would be out of place. Amusements that weaken love for sacred things are not to be sought by Christians. The music and dancing in joyful praise of God at the removal of the ark had not the faintest resemblance to the dissipation of modern dancing. The one exalted God's holy name. The other is a device of Satan to cause men to forget and dishonor God. The triumphal procession approached the capital. Then a burst of song demanded of the watchers upon the walls that the gates of the holy city be thrown open. "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." A band of singers and players answered, "Who is this King of glory?" From another company came the response, "The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle." Then hundreds of voices, uniting, swelled the triumphal chorus. "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Again was heard, "Who is the King of glory?" And the voice of the great multitude, like the sound of many waters, was heard in rapturous reply, "The Lord of hosts, he is the King of glory." Psalm 24, verse 7-10. Then the gates were opened wide, and with reverent awe, the ark was deposited in the tent prepared for its reception. The service ended, the king himself pronounced a benediction upon his people. This celebration was the most sacred event that had yet marked the reign of David. As the last beams of the setting sun bathed the tabernacle in hallowed light, the king's heart was uplifted in gratitude to God that the blessed symbol of his presence was now so near the throne of Israel. But there was one who witnessed the scene of rejoicing with a spirit widely different. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. She went out to meet him and poured forth a torrent of bitter words, keen and cutting. How glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants, as one of the vain fellows shamelessly uncovereth himself. David felt that it was the service of God which Michal had despised, and he answered, "It was before the Lord which chose me before thy father, and before all his house, to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore will I play before the Lord. And I will yet be more vile than thus, and will be base in mine own sight. And of the maidservants which thou hast spoken of them shall I be had in honor." To David's rebuke was added that of the Lord. Because of her pride and arrogance, Michal had no child unto the day of her death. Nation freed from idolatry. The removal of the ark had made a lasting impression upon the people of Israel, kindling anew their zeal for Jehovah. David endeavored to deepen these impressions. Song was made a regular part of religious worship, and David composed psalms to be sung by the people in their journeys to the annual feasts. The influence thus exerted resulted in freeing the nation from idolatry. Many of the surrounding peoples were led to think favorably of Israel's God, who had done such great things for his people. David had erected a palace for himself, and he felt that it was not fitting for the Ark of God to rest within a tent. He determined to build for it a temple of such magnificence as should express Israel's appreciation of the abiding presence of Jehovah their King. Communicating his purpose to the prophet Nathan, he received the response, "Do all that is in thine heart, for the Lord is with thee." But that same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, giving him a message for the king. "The Lord telleth thee that he will make thee a house. I will set up thy seed after thee. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." The reason David was not to build the temple was declared, "Thou hast shed blood abundantly, and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build a house unto my name. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies. His name shall be Solomon, peaceable, and I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name." 1 Chronicles 22:8-10. Though the cherished purpose of his heart had been denied, David received the message with gratitude. He knew that it would be an honor to his name to perform the work he had purposed to do, but he was ready to submit to the will of God. How often those who have passed the strength of manhood cling to the hope of accomplishing some great work which they are unfitted to perform. God's providence may speak, declaring that it is theirs to prepare the way for another to accomplish it. But instead of gratefully submitting to divine direction, many fall back as if slighted. If they cannot do the one thing they desire to do, they will do nothing. Many vainly endeavor to accomplish a work for which they are insufficient, while that which they might do lies neglected. And because of this, the greater work is hindered. David, in his covenant with Jonathan, had promised that he would show kindness to the house of Saul. Mindful of this, the king made inquiry, "Is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" He was told of a son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, who had been lame from childhood. The nurse of this child had let him fall, making him a lifelong cripple. David now summoned the young man to court, and the private possessions of Saul were restored to him for the support of his household. But the son of Jonathan was himself to be the constant guest of the king. Mephibosheth had been led to cherish a strong prejudice against David as a usurper, but the monarch's continued kindness won the heart of the young man. Like his father Jonathan, he felt that his interest was one with that of the king whom God had chosen. After David's establishment upon the throne of Israel, the nation enjoyed a long interval of peace. The surrounding peoples soon thought it prudent to desist from open hostilities, and David refrained from aggressive war. At last, however, he made war upon Israel's old enemies, the Philistines and Moabites, and made them tributary. Hostile nations plot against David. Then there was formed against David a vast coalition of surrounding nations, out of which grew the greatest wars and greatest victories of his reign, and the most extensive accessions to his power. This hostile alliance had been wholly unprovoked by him. The circumstances were these. Tidings were received at Jerusalem, announcing the death of Nahash, king of the Ammonites, who had shown kindness to David when he was a fugitive from Saul. Desiring to express his appreciation of the favor shown him in his distress, David sent a message of sympathy to Hanun, son of the Ammonite king. The message of David was misconstrued by Hanun's counselors. They said unto Hanun their lord, "Thinkest thou that David does honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee, to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it?" They could have no conception of the generous spirit that inspired David's message. Listening to his counselors, Hanun regarded David's messengers as spies and loaded them with scorn and insult. The Ammonites had been permitted to carry out the evil purposes of their hearts that their real character might be revealed to David. It was not God's will that Israel enter into a league with this heathen people. Knowing that the insult offered to Israel would surely be avenged, the Ammonites made preparation for war. The inhabitants of the region between the river Euphrates and the Mediterranean leagued with the Ammonites to crush Israel. The Hebrews did not wait for the invasion. Under Joab, they advanced toward the Ammonite capital. The united forces of the allies were overcome in the first engagement, but the next year they renewed the war. David took the field in person, and by the blessing of God, inflicted a defeat so disastrous that the Syrians, from Lebanon to the Euphrates, not only gave up the war, but became tributary to Israel. The dangers that threatened the nation with destruction proved to be the means by which it rose to greatness. Commemorating his deliverance, David sings, "Blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation. Even the God that executeth vengeance for me, and subdueth peoples under me. He rescueth me from mine enemies." Psalm 18, verse 46 to 48. Throughout the songs of David, the thought was impressed on his people that Jehovah was their strength and deliverer. "Some trust in chariots, and some in horses, but we will remember the name of Jehovah our God." Psalm 20, verse 7. The kingdom of Israel had now reached in extent the fulfillment of the promise given to Abraham. "Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates." Genesis 15, verse 18. Israel had become a mighty nation, respected and feared by surrounding peoples. David commanded, as few sovereigns have been able to command, the affections and allegiance of his people. He had honored God, and God was now honoring him. But in the time of his greatest outward triumph, David met his most humiliating defeat.